From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Republican health care reform now hangs by a thread. Hello again, I'm Aaron Almy, and this is To the Point. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell does not yet have what he needs to get rid of Obamacare. It will only take two Republican defectors to break 7 years of promises. Several moderates and conservatives are threatening to vote no, so today McConnell announced he's delayed the vote till after the July 4th recess. His measure reduces the federal deficit, which could provide the resources needed for political horse trading. President Trump may be poised to retaliate in hopes of getting a win. House Speaker Paul Ryan says, "I would not bet against Mitch McConnell." Later on today's Talking Point, entrapment, interrogation, and torture, the stories of gay men fleeing the LGBT purge in Chechnya. First, the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Mormon Alney back with To the Point. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has a new argument for Republicans who aren't ready to support his version of health care reform. If it's not passed after the July 4th recess, they might have to work with the Democrats. We'll hear more about the effort to gut Obamacare. On today's Talking Point later, Russia is not a safe place to be openly gay. But we'll compare it to Chechnya's campaign of torture and interrogation. We'll hear about gay men fleeing from Chechnya to live undercover in Vladimir Putin's Russia. First, this news update. Another wave of powerful cyber attacks started in Europe today, and so far it's affected companies in India and the United States. In Ukraine, it shut down the major airport and the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Mikko Häpinen is a cybersecurity expert in Helsinki, Finland. Thanks so much for joining our program.
Thank you very much.
Understand this is called a Petya virus. What does that mean?
Well, Petya is a Russian name, and the code that resembles this one very much has been known for 2 years as Petya. And when we look at what's really happening right now, it really does remind us of what happened 4 weeks ago with WannaCry. It is a very similar attack.
What does that mean? How would you describe it?
This one spreads automatically to corporate networks. So almost all of the victims we've seen today have been very large companies. And we have victims in dozens of countries around the world right now. So this is a major outbreak. Once it hits computers, it encrypts the files on the computers, shows the user of the computer a message on screen, which asks you to send a ransom of $300. And if you send the money, they are supposed to send back to you a key, which will unlock your files for you.
So what are the chances of getting the key if you pay the $300?
Right now, the chances are zero, because you're supposed to send the money in Bitcoin, which you are able to do, and people are doing that. We're actually seeing money being sent. But after that, you're supposed to send them an email to this free email service in Germany, and that free email service provider has actually shut down the address. So right now, nobody is able to get their files back by paying the ransom.
So compare this to what happened with WannaCry. Were companies, in fact, shut down indefinitely because of that?
No, companies were not shut down indefinitely because most victims with WannaCry as well were very large companies. And large companies have backup policies and backup systems. So even if this happens, they can recover. They can get their files back in almost all of the cases. In fact, they typically don't need to pay the ransom. They can just use backups. What is different is that WannaCry was stopped in its tracks. It was stopped in just 5 hours from the beginning of the outbreak. And we've now been watching Petya spreading for 6-7 hours already, and there's no stopping it. There's nothing in the code that could be used to stop the spread globally, unlike WannaCry.
Pretty disturbing that the Chernobyl nuclear power plant has been affected. That suggests that major facilities like that could indeed be shut down with all of the dangers that that implies, not just from the loss of electricity, but in the case of nuclear power plants, because of the radiation.
Well, it is, of course, concerning. However, the most critical systems in power plants and similar facilities are offline. They will not be able to gain access to the most critical parts of these systems. However, they will be able to shut down office networks and payroll and things like that, which, of course, is a major problem. But I'm not worried about a meltdown.
Which companies in the United States that you're aware of have been hit so far?
There's already been quite a few. Many of them have publicly reported the fact already. There's been a major advertisement agency, a major transportation company, and so on. So this is a big deal, and it's still growing.
It's still growing, and what's the significance of it being worldwide? Does that mean that it could shut down, shipping, for example, or air travel?
The reason why WannaCry was limited to Europe 4 weeks ago when it was spreading was simply because of time zones. WannaCry started right after midday European time, which means it was a Friday. In Asia, companies had already closed and went home for the weekend. And in USA, it was way too early for companies to be, for employees to be at their offices. So most of the victims during the 5 hours that WannaCry was spreading were in Europe. With Petya, there's no limitation. It's going to continue spreading, and we will see infections. In fact, we already have seen infections all over the world.
What about municipalities, counties and cities and other government organizations?
We saw pretty bad problems, we are seeing pretty bad problems in organizations like these, because they typically have fairly limited budgets for their IT departments. They have smaller departments, and it's harder to maintain your machines and keep everything secured and patched up. And unfortunately, it typically requires some sort of a catastrophe for this to change. But maybe this is now one of those things which will make it better.
Any idea who's behind it?
No real idea. It is. There's lots of speculation that it's the same party which was behind WannaCry, but we can't really confirm anything yet.
Okay, so Petya may become a household word if this gets even worse. Mikko Hyppinen in Helsinki, Finland, thank you so much for helping us better understand it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
In a moment, Senate Republicans are not just down to the wire. Healthcare reform now hangs by a thread. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wanted his version of health care reform passed by Thursday. But yesterday's report by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projected that the number of Americans with insurance would drop by 22 million in 10 years. That was enough for his fellow Republican Susan Collins to get off a series of tweets announcing she would vote against even starting debate. She says the bill hurts most vulnerable Americans, threatens access to health care in rural areas, doesn't fix problems in her state of Maine, where hospitals are already struggling. She is not alone, and McConnell now has delayed the vote until after the July 4th recess. Jeffrey Young is senior reporter at HuffPost. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So this is a big surprise. We didn't expect this to happen. McConnell has been pretty firm on this deadline. What is this? In how many ways does this change the situation in Washington?
Well, it is. You're right. It's quite a turn. I mean, everyone was expecting these votes to begin tomorrow and go through Thursday or Friday, and then that will be it. What I think interesting to note, maybe, is that so far, almost beat by beat, the way that this health care bill has played out among Senate Republicans is nearly identical to what happened in the House. And so I think it's important to point out at this moment where it's clear that Senator McConnell does not have the votes to move this bill forward, that Speaker Ryan didn't either, and eventually he did. So, you know, we'll see what happens when they come back. But, of course, the problem, the internal politics among Senate Republicans is that you've got, you mentioned Senator Collins, who said that she wouldn't vote against the procedural motion that would have started the floor debate. And she wasn't the only one who said that. You've also got Senator Dean Heller from Nevada, who said not only would he vote against that motion, but he was planning to vote against the bill unless they changed it. And on the more conservative side of the Senate Republican Conference, there are four senators there, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, and Ron Johnson, who are all more or less saying the same thing. And the problem is that, much like in the House, although, as I said, they did get through this, what these two camps are asking for are mutually incompatible. The conservative wing wants further deregulation and less money available for health care programs for low-income people, whereas the, you know, quote-unquote moderate senators on the other side of that spectrum are looking for a number that's something smaller than 22 million people losing coverage. None of them have said what amount of people losing coverage would be okay with them, but they've made clear that 22 is too many.
22 in this case, 23 was the estimate of the Congressional Budget Office for the House bill. How do the conservatives justify people not getting insurance, people who now have it or would be, I mean, would be entitled to it? I should say it's not just 22 million that are going to be lopped off suddenly, but 22 million less than would have it otherwise in the next 10 years.
That's correct. To put it another way, that's maybe a little easier to understand, and I need to remind myself of that. What the Congressional Budget Office said is that under current law, which is to say the Affordable Care Act and Medicare and all the other programs that exist today, in addition to everyone who gets their insurance from their employers, of course, in 2026, there would be 28 million Americans who didn't have any health insurance. Under the bill the Senate has postponed voting on, that number would be 49 million.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a lot larger, already a bunch of people for a variety of reasons. Maybe we can talk about why some other day. It's a lot more than would have been, as opposed to, you're correct, it's not as though 22 million people would get kicked off their insurance policies tomorrow, although the Congressional Budget Office did say that 15 million of that 22 would be next year.
So that's a lot, and that would be fast, and there's an election next year.
Yes, that's correct. There's plenty you can quibble about the CBO analysis of all of this, but I think the simple thing that can't be overlooked is those are very large numbers. I mean, even if they're off by half, well, then it's 11 million people. You know, I mean, is Susan Collins comfortable with that? Are other people? And to answer the question you asked a moment ago, I mean, part of what's playing out here is a very basic philosophical disagreement. You know, I mean, I don't want to speak for Ted Cruz with any specificity, but, you know, there is a strain of conservatism that has a lot more influence within the Republican Party than it did 10, 20 years ago that simply believes that it's not the government's responsibility to make sure that people who can't afford medical care get it. And if you don't believe it's the government's responsibility to do that, you would be in favor of a bill that would reduce the federal government's role in this. And that is essentially what, you know, Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and the others are asking for. What they want to see is the Affordable Care Act completely repealed and then Medicaid further curtailed, further shrunk down, even from what the McConnell bill would do.
Another feature of the McConnell bill, though, is something like $200 billion knocked off the deficit in order to perhaps provide horse trading opportunities or political bribery, if you want to look at it in a harsh light, for senators that might be willing to make a move. Will the additional time now that McConnell has asked for give him an opportunity to work those members?
I'm sure he must be thinking that. In terms of just looking at the short time frame and saying, you know, the demands I'm getting from people, and there are probably also senators whose names we don't know who have just asked him, like, we need to slow down a little bit, even though I'm going to vote with you in the end. I don't like the way this looks. And yeah, he does now have, because for a whole bunch of boring reasons that people don't fully understand, the budget rules that are governing this bill requires it to save a certain amount of money off the federal government. What McConnell and his team team have done is saved about $200 billion more than that. So as you said, that gives them some money to play with. And you can imagine, it's a tried and true tradition in the Congress, you could satisfy a senator from a particular state by, funneling some of that money toward them in order to win over their support and enable them to say to their constituents, well, I'm not sure about this whole bill, but I think I've got us taken care of. The problem is that as much as $200 billion sounds like a lot of money, that's only about a fifth of the amount of cuts to healthcare programs that are contained in this bill. You'd have to give a lot of it to one person. And, of course, as soon as you start doing that, a line forms and everybody else wants something.
Sure. Jeffrey Young, once again at HuffPost. Sarah Bender is with us. She's senior fellow with the Brookings Institution, professor of political science at George Washington University, and co-author of a forthcoming book, The Myth of Independence, How Congress Governs the Federal Reserve. Sarah Bender, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Back to healthcare reform. What do you see as the consequence of this sudden change in strategy by Senator Mitch McConnell today?
Well, certainly today's events, the postponement of the vote, it creates a new challenge for Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, right, who seemed to have wanted to do everything behind closed doors, do it quickly before opposition could mount, push that vote home for recess and move on to other issues that Republicans would care more about. Today suggests he doesn't have the votes. It will complicate McConnell's strategy. I don't know that it necessarily undermines his ability to get it passed. But it does raise a couple of questions here, right? We do have the analogy of the House, which took a long break when it didn't have the votes and they came back. They did eventually get it through the House. The question is that going to be the model for McConnell? I'm not so sure. A couple differences here to keep in mind. First, as we've talked about, right, much tighter margins for McConnell to get this done. He can only lose two Republican senators. Second, right, even though he only needs Republican votes, Republican senators, even from red states, tend to represent broader sets of voters than their House counterparts do. So just because the House could pull this off, I don't know if it's quite so easy in the Senate. Keep in mind one other factor, as Jeff just mentioned, really the House. When they renegotiated their bill, they pulled that bill to the far right. That's not the typical pattern in the Senate, right? And it's very hard to do for this bill under special budget rules. So, but as you've said, look, they have close to $200 billion to spread around. We know where the squeaky wheels are here. But there may, in fact, be more senators who have not quite ready to jump on board, even though we haven't heard their names in the press.
What are the consequences if they don't get this bill passed?
Well, I could see it two different ways here. I mean, on the one hand, the big pressure, I think, on Republicans has been to follow through on this campaign promise that they've made year after year.
7 years.
For a policy or a set of proposals that, as far as I can tell, still have support amongst Republican voters. Not all Republican voters, but certainly far more Republicans, more popular amongst Republicans than amongst Democrats and independents nobody seems to really support it. And that assumes people know what's at stake here. So one way to look at this is that if they can't get it done, it's a blow to that Republican promise. Will voters hold them accountable? I'm not so sure. I think they will be held accountable for the state of healthcare and whether or not Republicans have been able to do anything about rising costs. On the other hand, the healthcare is not really an issue that we say Republicans own. It's really a Democratic issue. It's been Democrats historically that have pushed to expand benefits and to improve access to health care. I have some sense that McConnell would like it off his plate. I think he'd like to win, but I think he'd also like it off his plate. For procedural rules, if they want to do tax reform, they have to kill off reconciliation, either get it to the president's desk or decide they're really done and not going to act on it anymore. So by hook or by crook, I think by the end of the summer, they will have moved on.
reconciliation, one of those Senate rules that are somewhat complicated and we don't need to go into in great detail at the moment. Again, Sarah Binder is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Let's talk to a Democrat who, in fact, has been very involved in this entire issue. He is Steve Beshear. He is the former Democratic governor of Kentucky. He embraced Obamacare, expanded Medicaid in his home state. He's now author of a new book, People Over Politics. And Governor, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
How many people got insurance, health insurance, as a result of your action? How many would lose it if the Republican plans were to pass?
We had one of the most successful rollouts of the Affordable Care Act in the country, as a lot of people know. In 18 months, we dropped our uninsured rate from over 20% down to 7%. A half a million Kentuckians signed up in 18 months for either qualified health plans or for expanded Medicaid. Now, keep in mind, we only have a little over 4 million people totally in the state. So it was a tremendous success. And what Mitch McConnell is doing is embarrassing a lot of people in Kentucky right now. I can tell you that, because what he's proposing is directly contrary to the best interest of all of these Kentuckians. You know, we have so many Kentuckians that depend upon Medicaid for basic health coverage and health insurance. And this action, and the CBO said it very clearly, the millions that are going to get thrown off, there's going to be hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians thrown off. And, you know, keep in mind that while we're talking about the Affordable Care Act, McConnell's bill goes even further and attacks the basic Medicaid program and is going to reduce the money over time in that program. And that means that hundreds of thousands of more people in Kentucky, that's the disabled, that's folks in nursing homes that have always been on this plan, they're going to get thrown off of it, too. You know, these folks ought to be ashamed of themselves.
There was a lot of support, according to Sarah Binder, though, despite the consequences of this bill. And the fact is that Senator McConnell's in office and you're not. Why is that?
Well, it's because he learned the trick of getting reelected many years ago, and that is have the most money. You know, when he first started in politics, he was for limiting spending in campaigns, but he found out very quickly that the person with the most money wins 9 out of 10 times. And so he switched. And now if somebody runs against him and you have $1 million, he will have $10 million. I mean, he has become the king of fundraising and he knows how to win. He's one of the most unpopular politicians in Kentucky. You take any poll and he'll be right down at the bottom, but he always runs his campaign not to get people to like him, but just to get whoever's running against him to be more disliked than him.
Okay, so let me interrupt you just for a moment because we need to go to a break and we'll come back. We'll hear more from the governor. But I want to give Jeffrey Young a final comment here because he needs to leave, a senior reporter at the HuffPost who we started out with. We're hearing some pretty tough political talk here, and I gather we're going to hear it for quite a while.
Well, you know, and to pick up on what the governor was talking about in your question, you know, part of what complicates this in terms of the politics is that not only are a lot of these senators who are on the fence not up for reelection for several years, but most of them won by a lot, and Donald Trump won their states by a lot in the presidential election. So, you know, Rob Portman may have 3 million Medicaid beneficiaries in his state, but he won by 20 points last year. He's not up for 6 years. So
Republican in Ohio.
That's correct. Doesn't necessarily have that much to be afraid of at the ballot box.
Okay. Jeffrey Young, once again with HuffPost. Thanks a lot for being with us. We'll continue with our current guests and add others as well on our talking point letter, Entrapment, Interrogation, and Torture. The story of gay men fleeing the LGBT purge in the country of Chechnya, and they're fleeing to Russia. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing.
Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're only back with To the Point. Once again, as we've heard already on our program, it's been 7 years that the Republicans have been promising to get rid of Obamacare. President Trump has promised to make insurance both better and more affordable. Now there are so few votes, Republican votes, for the Republican version of repeal and replace Obamacare that the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, has had to postpone the vote. We just heard from the former Democratic governor of that state, who says everybody who's supporting this ought to be embarrassed. Certainly the people in Kentucky should. Dean Clancy is with us. He's a health policy analyst, was senior budget official in the George W. Bush administration. Thank you for being back on our program.
Oh, my pleasure.
After the House bill passed, you came on this program, said you thought the Senate would straighten out whatever problems it might have. How do you feel about the Senate bill and its chances, especially now that the vote's been postponed?
Did I say that? I'm afraid the Senate has not worked out the problems. And in fact, I'm thinking now that we may look back in a few months and realize that the entire Republican repeal effort died this afternoon in the Senate Republican caucus luncheon, where McConnell realized he didn't have 50 votes for the Senate Obamacare repeal bill. And I'm thinking he may not even have 40 votes for it, because there are a lot of quiet Republican senators who aren't speaking up right now. And I think that's because ultimately the Senate Republicans just aren't there for doing anything serious to change Obamacare. Well, I think that it's possible that over the next few weeks they could kind of pull it out of the ditch and get something that can get through the Senate, sort of like what happened in the House back in March and April. I think that's probably a real uphill climb for them. And so I think, I could be wrong, but I think Obamacare repeal may have died today.
Are these quiet senators who aren't speaking up people who, unlike Mitch McConnell, are up for re-election next year?
Well, I don't know that, as a previous caller or speaker here mentioned, it's not necessarily that they are up for re-election soon. It's just that a number of these Republican senators do have large Medicaid populations in their states. And I do think Medicaid has a bigger impact on a lot of the Republican senators than the other provisions of Obamacare. And when you've got a big Medicaid population, then you ask yourself, what do I do about that if I'm trying to control Medicaid spending, which the Republicans definitely are trying to do in the bill. Most of Obamacare's coverage gains were actually because of expanded Medicaid enrollment. And these bills, to the extent that they do reduce health insurance coverage, it's mostly because of reduced Medicaid enrollment. So a lot of these Republican senators, I think, are just nervous about touching that program.
Children, poor people, elderly people, those who are the most vulnerable are the ones who are covered by Medicaid.
Yes, that's right. And Medicaid started out in the 60s as a poor people's program tied to cash welfare, and then it evolved over time so that now it has begun to be, in some ways, a middle-class entitlement. A lot of people in the middle class rely on Medicaid, for example, for nursing home care for their elderly family members, and it's politically very tricky to touch that. So if anything killed the bill in the Senate, and of course, you know, it could come back to life, but if it's dead, it may be because of the Medicaid aspect.
Let me ask you about another startling thing that's happened today. The Republican senator from Alaska, Lisa Murkowski, said on MSNBC that she now wants to work with the Democrats to fix Obamacare. Dean Clancy, are there other Republicans, do you think, who will go that far?
Well, we haven't heard any, because Obamacare has been a purely partisan issue since at least 2009. And it has been kind of a political death knell for a Republican to hint that he or she wants to keep Obamacare or wants to work with Democrats to fix Obamacare. But we've had a kind of development in the last month here where Senate Republicans have more or less come out with a bill that fixes Obamacare, as they see it, rather than trying to repeal or even replace it. And so the next logical step is to say, well, you know what, the bills are so similar to the status quo, why don't we just go ahead and negotiate with the Democrats who authored the status quo and see if we can't get a bipartisan bill.
Dean Clancy, once again, formerly with the George W. Bush administration as a senior budget official. Let me go back to the former governor, Democratic governor of Kentucky, Steve Beshear. Do you think that the current proposals are, in fact, a lot like Obamacare? Beyond that, whatever you think of that issue, do you think that it's time for Republicans and Democrats to work together?
Well, certainly what is on the table right now doesn't say we're repealing the whole thing. And I think that's the, you know, that's the Rand Paul and the Ted Cruz's of the world. That's their problem with it. You know, they want to march us back, I think, to about the 19th and 18th century in terms of health care coverage. But, you know, what the senator from Alaska said today is what should be happening. And it should be happening not only on health care, but on a lot of other issues. I want to tell you something. The people of this country, both Republican and Democrat, are frustrated as heck about politics in Washington. They are mad at both parties because they see nobody that's willing to sit down and work with each other like our system is supposed to do. And instead, all they do is yell and scream at each other and then walk off, raise more money so they can come back the next day, get reelected, and yell and scream at each other. And people are just frustrated as heck with this partisan gridlock. You know, if the senator from Alaska and some of the other Republicans would approach the Democrats and they would get together in a bipartisan fashion on this issue, which if there is a nonpartisan issue, it ought to be the health care of the American people, because those folks out there that need this are both Democrats and Republicans. If they'll do that, you might actually see a change in the way the political system works in this country, because right now it doesn't work, and that would hopefully get it started working again.
Steve Beshear again, former governor of Kentucky, a good Democrat. Sarah Binder, back to you with the Brookings Institution, also a political professor, science professor, excuse me, at George Washington University. What do you think about that, and is that something that President Trump would want to see happen? He has made so much of partisanship and the difference between him and the Democrats, and regarding so many things as either wins or losses.
Well, it's really hard for me to get a sense of what Trump would think about moving to in a bipartisan way. It's certainly the case for Republican majorities, particularly the House, all of whom will face voters in 2018, that these midterm elections, when a single party controls the White House and both chambers of Congress, it's a referendum on the president. It's a referendum on that party and what they've delivered, what they've stood for. So long as Republicans are doing something that by broad public measure is unpopular, that's troublesome for Republicans, and they will be held accountable for the state of health care policy, for the state of Obamacare, regardless, right, of whether they act today or whether they don't act at all. And my sense is that if this particular bill goes down, that they will eventually probably have to deal, maybe in a bigger, broader spending deal, they'll have to deal with these insurance subsidies. They have to find a way to, as best they can, stabilize the Obamacare exchanges, because they're going to be held accountable by them, particularly by new Republican voters who turned out for Trump and may or may not turn out for them in 2018.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Excuse me.
I was just going to say, just to keep in mind, it's not unusual to see these gangs in the Senate, and think about with tight margins, it would take a gang of three Republicans, a gang of three Democrats to put the kibosh on moving forward with Obamacare repeal replace, right? To say, hold on, let's do this in a different direction.
Okay, gangs in the Senate, that's a wonderful term, and it has been applied in many situations. But let me ask you about the Democrats. They're not exactly speaking with one voice. Now, Elizabeth Warren has said, of course, she's the Democrat from Massachusetts, that it is time for the Democrats to put into their party platform the demand for single-payer health coverage in the United States. How likely do you think it is that the Democrats will do that, and would it be a winner next year?
Well, I mean, the writing of party platforms is typically revolves around nomination of a presidential candidate. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see it for 2020. We don't typically see contracts or campaigns or platforms. We sometimes do for the House party, for Senate party, but we're much less likely to see that at a midterm election, right? Because these are not all of Senate Democrats are up for election anyway in 2018. I could see Democrats moving toward that slowly as a party. I don't necessarily see it front and center in 2018. But again, because of the nature of these midterm elections, they really are referendum on who's in control. It's not a choice between party platforms. It's what did you think of Republicans running government?
Steve Beshear, former Democratic governor of Kentucky. You were once again somebody who really embraced Obamacare and Medicaid in particular and managed to get a lot of people insured as a result. How do you feel about single payer? Do you think it's something your party ought to embrace?
Well, single payer, if you could go back and start all over, maybe that is an approach that could work in America. But you've got so many stakeholders now in the healthcare industry in the United States. I really don't see that as a viable alternative. I mean, in theory, we can talk about it all day long, but what President Obama did was take a Republican idea that Mitt Romney made successful in Massachusetts when he was governor and take it nationwide. And while it's not perfect, and there are things that need to be fixed with the Affordable Care Act, at least it really moved the ball down the field. We got millions more people insured than ever before in history in the United States. And in my mind, what the Democrats need to be doing is concentrating on fixing what's broken with the Affordable Care Act. But more importantly, we've got to get back to the basics in our party. You know, we've lost our ability to communicate with the average American out here. You can't be a national party when you only win elections on the two coasts. We've got to get back out in middle America and talk to people in terms that they can understand about job opportunities, about good public education in order to get those jobs, and about getting a piece of the American dream. And we've got to communicate it in a way that appeals to the everyday folks out here who really agree for the most part with our philosophy about jobs and education and health care. But we've gotten out-communicated really badly.
Let me go back to Dean Clancy again, who was a senior budget official in the George W. Bush administration and not a fan of either of the bills that have been presented so far. But what about the fact that Obamacare, as just described by the governor, was originally based on a Republican idea that was put into effect in Massachusetts by the Republican Mitt Romney? My understanding is that more than 90% of people in Massachusetts now have health insurance. Is that something that Republicans ought to be paying more attention to? Is there room for them to compromise here?
Well, the governor is right. Obamacare is really a nationalized version of Romney Care, and Romney Care was really a Massachusetts implementation of the old Heritage Foundation health care plan from the early 1990s, and it's true, it's a Republican idea. Now, some of us on the conservative side have never liked that approach, managed competition, we call it, because we don't really believe that competition in the marketplace should be managed by the government. We think that it can work just fine on its own with reasonable rules and guardrails, such as we have had in states that have regulated their own insurance markets traditionally in this country right up until the ACA. And in fact, that's the vision we want to go back to. Jeffrey Young at the beginning of this program talked about folks wanting, like Ted Cruz, wanting to get government out. That's exactly right. And the reason is because you can get health care costs down if you can get government regulations out of the way. When costs come down, more people find insurance a good value for money. They buy it. More people get insured. Everything works better. So it's really a difference between the two worldviews about how you get to better health care for everybody. Obamacare, unfortunately, and the Heritage Plan that it's based on, both assume that if you put the government in charge, you can make it work. I think we're seeing the proof with the collapse of the Obamacare exchanges that that isn't the case. Healthcare costs are not coming down, and people are still upset and unhappy about healthcare. And unfortunately, the House and Senate Republican bills don't do anything fundamentally to change that. So we are going to need a serious health reform, but it's going to have to be something much more market-oriented and commonsensical than what we've been doing for the past 25 years.
Since we began this program, Senator McConnell has made a statement during which he said that he is still trying to litigate the differences over the bill, as he put it, trying to get 50 senators to a comfortable place, as he puts it. And of course, he means 50 Republican senators. That's what they need, because with the vice president, Mr. Pence, they could, in fact, get the bill passed if they had those votes. I want to ask very quickly a question of Sarah Binder once again at the Brookings Institution. And this goes back to the Trump administration. We just heard about the exchanges collapsing. The federal government can do something about that. There have been those who have said that it might be that the Trump administration could sabotage the exchanges by the way that it dealt with the money that's now available. Do you anticipate that happening? And if so, what would the political consequences be?
Well, I don't think it's a done deal that the Trump administration will step into the breach and try to stabilize the exchanges. And I say that in part because some of the rhetoric, or almost all the rhetoric that comes from the president via mostly via his Twitter feed, is let's watch it collapse and let Democrats own it. I don't think politically Democrats will own it. But given that approach, given Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Price's seeming reluctance to step up the plate and execute the law, take care that the law be faithfully executed on this issue where the law is on the books. I'm not a policy person, but I think the politics here, at least at the moment, does not give me hope that the administration will step in. They may yet come to that position, particularly if it becomes clear to him, to the administration, that there will not be legislative action to undo Obamacare. But I don't think I can't quite see the path forward yet where there will be a concerted effort to make the exchanges work.
Okay. Once again, Mitch McConnell has delayed the vote on the Senate version of the repeal and replacement of Obamacare, if in fact that's an accurate description of it. There's much more to come. Once again, we're talking about 1/6 of the entire economy and an issue that, of course, affects everybody in a very, very important way, whether they recognize that's going to happen or not. It almost invariably does. Sarah Binder with the Brookings Institution, thanks to you. Thanks to Steve Beshear, the former Democratic governor of Kentucky, Dean Clancy, formerly with the George W. Bush administration as a senior budget official, and Jeffrey Young of the Huff Post. Good to have you all on our program, and many thanks again. In a moment, gay men flee from Chechnya to the relative safety of Russia. This is To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren on the air with today's talking point. The Russian journalist Masha Gessen left Moscow to live in the United States. For a story in the current edition of the New Yorker magazine, she returned to Russia to write about dozens of gay men who have fled there from Chechnya to avoid a brutal campaign against the LGBT community by the government, by neighbors, even by family members. Masha Gessen, welcome as always.
Thank you.
You begin your story in the New Yorker magazine with a description of the most horrible kind of physical abuse conducted, apparently, by the government of Chechnya. Why is this happening?
Well, why is this happening? You know, that's actually a huge question because it goes to the root of our desire to make sense of the behavior of these kinds of tyrannies. right? People have been looking for an event that triggered the purges of gay men. The thing about tyrannies or these kinds of regimes, I don't even know what to call Kadyrov's regime, but I think it is, you know, basically a tyranny, is that they control their populations by acting in a predictably frightening manner, but not in a predictable pattern. So there's no why there, right? There's not necessarily a trigger. You may as well just say, why not? This is a violent regime where people get pulled in for all sorts of things, including, for example, I heard one person give this example, that if you write on a social network that you feel you overpaid for your electrical bill, you will get pulled into the authorities' offices and made to apologize publicly. That's the kind of regime that Kadyrov, who's Putin appointed president of Chechnya, runs. So right now, randomly enough, their target is gay men.
So describe Ali, for example, a married man who was swept up and tortured for 7 days and then fled to Moscow.
Right. So Ali, like many men in Chechnya, many gay men in Chechnya, was married. Was very devoted to his family. He has two small children, two toddlers, and one more baby on the way. He, of course, was not out to his wife or to any of his family. He was certain that if his family ever found out that he was gay, he would immediately be killed by his relatives. And he was always careful in Chechnya not to form any relationships. He dreamed of a relationship with a man, but he only ever hooked up. And one day he got a phone call from the police saying that they were coming to pick him up. He immediately switched out the SIM card from his phone into a blank handset. That's the kind of thing that people in Chechnya know to do if they have something to hide. He was picked up. He was taken to a facility outside the city of Grozny, the capital of Chechnya. He saw two men that he knew, two gay men. They had been badly beaten. And one of them said, I told them everything. They know everything. Then he was taken in to see a man that he referred to as the boss. The boss told him to confess that he was a homosexual. Ali said, I don't know anything about this. I didn't even know that there were gays in Chechnya. Then he was taken down to the basement, which was equipped for torture. So there were holding cells around the perimeter of a large room. And the large room was used for beatings. And some of the cells around the perimeter weren't holding cells. Some of them were torture cells. So there was a cell for with a vat of cold water where they would dunk your head. There was another cell that was set up to torture people with electrical current. So current would be connected to the men's earlobes or their fingers and then turned up and up and up. And he was tortured for some time. He doesn't know exactly how much time. But he continued to refuse to speak. And finally, they threw him into a cell and left him there without food. And that's where he was held for a week. He knows it was a week because he was still allowed to pray. And once a day, he was allowed to perform his ablutions and then drink the water that he had washed himself with. So that was the only water he got. That's the reason he survived. And that happened 7 times. So that's how he knows that he was held for more than a week.
All right. So we know that the horrors are being committed on a regular basis. But you said that he never hooked up, that he only dreamed about being gay. How did they know to call him in the first place?
No. I said that he only ever hooked up. He didn't have relationships.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Okay,
so
thank
you. He only had casual sex.
Okay, so there was he was active then in that regard. Well, you said that the tyrant that runs Chechnya was appointed by President Putin. What about Russia? How much better is it in Russia?
Well, you know, just about any country, not every country, but most countries would be better compared to what I just described.
Yeah, of course.
But basically, Russia, Chechnya is a part of Russia, and I think is the most extreme expression of Russia. The Kremlin has been running an anti-gay campaign for 5 years now. There's been a constant flow of homophobic propaganda from television, and there has been overt encouragement of anti-gay violence. So in Chechnya, that is taken to an extreme. But that happens with a lot of Kremlin policies, right? The Kremlin sort of cracks down on dissidents in a selective manner, and Chechnya just eradicates all dissidents altogether. The Kremlin makes great friends with the Russian Orthodox Church, and in Chechnya, a very, very crude sort of interpretation of Islam that's not really connected to the Quran in any meaningful way, that's made basically sort of the law of the land.
Okay, right? I'm going to interrupt you again because we're short of time, but I want to know a couple of things. One is you said that Ali indicated his relatives would kill him if they found out. I assume he's okay now that he is in Russia, but how is it that the regime has gotten relatives to kill people? They're presumably brothers, sisters, children, and so on, under these circumstances.
Well, it's a region where honor killings are still practiced. Usually, they're directed at women. Usually, it's women who are perceived as having had inappropriate contact, usually with men, who are killed by their relatives. But it is not uncommon for honor killings to be practiced in Chechnya. So to turn that to gay men is not a stretch of the imagination, and it seems to have been happening as part of these purges.
Okay. Time is the tyrant that we have to deal with on the radio, and I'm very sorry for that. But thank you for doing that. The story, again, is in the New Yorker magazine. It's called The Gay Men Who Fled Chechnya's Purge. It's written by Masha Gessen, who we have been talking to. And it's always good to have you on our program, and we'll look forward to the next time. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.